Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining for Spirit, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it's my honor to coordinate and host this program. The OU created Spirit several years ago, first as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as a virtual program for baby boomers, active retirees, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, all of us who are looking for opportunities for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since everyone is still all sheltering in, Spirit is the perfect way for each one of us to engage in a virtual setting. Today, we are very happy to welcome Mr. Stephen Savitsky to the Spirit program. Mr. Savitsky is a former president and chairman of the board of the Orthodox Union. In a non-COVID era, which we hope will happen soon, he speaks frequently for the OU as a scholar in residence in communities throughout the country, giving chizuk and inspiration wherever he goes. It's a treat to hear him. Today's program will address a topic that many of us are encountering regarding the finances of being a grandparent in today's Orthodox world. Now, today we are enabling the chat. And if you have any questions, please put them there and I will bring them up to Stephen after his presentation. But please remember, limit your questions and not comments. It's an honor now to turn the Spirit Forum over to Stephen Savitsky.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this wonderful program initiated by the Orthodox Union, and particularly thanking Robertson Steinig for developing it and coordinating it. Naturally, as the Robertson said, I am totally subjective about the Orthodox Union, having been a former president and chairman of the board. Once you do that, you have lev v'nefesh, you're dedicated to the organization, along with many other organizations that I'm involved in, but the Orthodox Union is, in my mind, the most important organization for the Torah world. It has so many facets and so many dimensions to it. I'm very proud to say that both my wife and I are not only grandparents, but we are great grandparents. And naturally, in my world and when I travel in my business world, I'm not a retiree yet. I still work in addition to other things. But people always ask, so how many children do you have? How many grandchildren do you have? And I always say considerable, because I don't think they really understand the world that we live in. They think they do, and while we certainly integrate into society, we are unique and we are different as Torah Jews. I have a good friend of ours who had two children. Today, she, Baruch Hashem, has 20 grandchildren. And this is where we are in our world. It's totally different than the secular world or the non-Torah world of Jews. I know that sometimes when I, just recently I was attending a wedding and I left, it was during the middle of the week. And people asked me, so it's very nice, you're going to a wedding in the middle of the week? And I said, yes, I'm going to a wedding in the middle of the week. They said, well, we just don't do that. I said, well, in my world, we do that. And I said, but it's a very big, wonderful occasion because the young lady is not that young. And so we're really excited. And they said, well, how old is she? I said, she's 25. And they look at me, what, 25? That's very young. I said, well, in my world, it's not. So we live in a little different world. We look like other people. We kind of mold into the world, but we are different. We are very, very different. And there's no question about it. And so the first thing I really wanted to do was kind of talk about a survey that was done several years ago by two different people, Anthony Gordon and Dick Hurwitz, when they talked about, will your grandchildren be Jewish? Because this is a big issue. Will your grandchildren be Jewish? This is an issue that's being dealt with all over the country as we have terrible assimilation. And I want to give you some numbers. And once you understand the numbers, you understand why we are where we are in our world today. Because we're not isolated. We're part of society. So where are we? So what he did is, what they did actually, is they looked at a group, different groups of people, and they said, will your grandchildren be Jewish? And they looked at four generations. So look at the numbers and you understand, once I give you the numbers, you have a better feel for what we're talking about. You take 200 secular Jews. After the first generation, the next generation, because of assimilation and intermarriage, there are now 82 Jews left. In the third generation, there are 34 Jews. And by the fourth generation, there are 14. Those are the numbers. Then you take a Reformed Jew. You start off with 200. Then the next generation, you have 92. Then you have 40. Then you have 28. Then you get to conservative Jews. You start off with 200. You have 135. You have 88. And in the fourth generation, you have 60. Now let's get to the Orthodox community. I'm putting everyone together. I don't really want to, I just want to look at the Torah world. I don't want to start looking at all the differentiating points that go on that someone is left of left, center of left, right of left, Hasidic, and so on. We're Torah Jews. What does it mean to be a Torah Jew? We believe in Maran HaSinai. We believe in Shabbos and Kashrus. We believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah. We believe in Yom Tovim. We believe in Halachas. We believe in Rabbanim. We believe in Shulchan Aruch. That's us. That's who we are, the Torah world. So look at the numbers for the Torah world, for the world of Orthodox Jews. You start off with 200 families initially. The next generation, you have 487 people. The following generation, you have 1,316. And then in the fourth generation, you have 3,835. So you see the numbers. The numbers are staggering because Baruch Hashem, we are doing it right. We have a very low assimilation rate. Our children get married early. They have children. And so we keep proliferating and proliferating, which is why, by the way, when sometimes people tell you, oh, the Orthodox community, very, very small part of where the world is in Jewish life. They may be right, but they're wrong. They're wrong because if you look at the numbers and you look at where we're going and where we're going to be, God willing, in the next 20 to 30 years, we will be the majority of the population in American diaspora Jewry. That's what will happen. It's unfortunate. I cry about this. I honestly do. I think it's a terrible thing, and I wish that the other movements would be able to keep their people intact, even though they've changed some of the rules of halacha, etc., but it hasn't worked. We, Baruch Hashem, have been able to make it work, and because of that, we have large numbers and large families. New York area, general area, about 35 to 40% of those under age 17 are today Orthodox Jews. So we've done a lot of things well. We should be proud, and Baruch Hashem, we should be proud of who we are. I mean, we've achieved great things, and I wouldn't change, even though we're going to talk a little bit about finances and the financial responsibilities that we have as grandparents, etc. Even though we're going to talk about that, I wouldn't trade it for a moment. I wouldn't want to be in anyone else's shoes. I'm so happy that I have so many grandchildren and now great grandchildren. I'm so happy I have a wonderful family, and I'm so happy I'm involved with them on a regular basis. Baruch Hashem, yom yom, we have so much to be proud of. But it does come with certain challenges. So let's not understand, you know, I don't want anyone to walk away and say, oh my God, woe is me. We have so many financial issues. No, we have financial issues because of who we are and what we've done. We have to try to figure out a way, how do we mitigate those financial issues and what happens. But let's all be proud of what we are. That's the first thing I always want to stress to make sure that everybody understands that. And you know, actually, Rabbi Sinsteinik, I don't think was here at the time at the OU, but every year at the OU, they used to give out awards for people who spent 25 years. And one year, there was a person named Anthony Lugo. Anthony Lugo, I still think he still works at the OU. I saw him there recently when I went to visit. But Anthony Lugo works at the OU for over 25 years. And so he got an award. At one of these dinners, he got an award. And he made one of the best speeches that anyone has ever made in the history of the OU. He got up and he said, you know, I came here 25 years ago. And 25 years ago when I came here, I knew nothing about Jewish people. I heard about them, but I didn't know them. He told the funny story about how there was a woman who was, he saw her and she tripped, unfortunately, and he tried to take her before she fell. And she said, no, don't touch me. I said, okay, so I let her fall. I didn't understand what was going on. It didn't make any sense to me. He said, but I've watched over the last 25 years. I have watched your families. I have seen your children come here. I have seen your grandchildren come here. I've seen your great-grandchildren come here. Wow, he said, I hear about your Shabbos. I hear about how you bless them on Friday night. I hear about how you sing songs together. He said, incredible. He said, what you've done with your families, the relationship between parents and children, grandchildren and grandparents, he said, it's unheard of. I wish I had something like that. So when you hear that from someone who's an outsider, someone who's not part of our faith, you understand that we're doing something right. And now I want to look at a hypothetical situation of two families. And I kind of set this up as a hypothetical family. I'm not sure that there is exactly correct, but I think there's enough to be said about this that makes it valid. So we're going to start with family number one, the typical American family, or unfortunately, it could be the typical American Jewish family, but certainly the typical American family. And so we have a wonderful couple, John and Mary Smith. Nice name. Two wonderful people who get married. John is an accountant. He's a CPA. He works for a big accounting firm. She, Mary, is a teacher. Very nice, very lovely couple. They get married when they're about 27, 28 years old, each one of them, they're the same age. And they wait, of course, to have their first child. And so at the age of 32, they have their first child, they have their girl. Important for them to have the girl. And then several years later, when they're 36, 37, 38, they have their boy. And that's their family. They did their job. They have a boy, they have a girl. They're now 38 years old. And now, of course, they, of course, start saving up from day one for the most important cost in their life, college education. We've got to save for college education. When our two children are ready to go, we've got to make sure we have money in the bank to send them to a good college so they can get a good education. And they begin day one to save. Their daughter gets married when she's about 25 years old. At that point, John and Mary are about 57 years old each. And they have their first grandchild. They're 60 years old. Baruch Hashem, they have their first grandchild. They're so happy, they're so excited. Their son gets married when he's about 27, so now they're about 63 years old. And they have their second grandchild when they're about 65 years old. And they hit that magic age, 65. Remember when people, first of all, thought it was old? Now we think it's young, but people think it's old. But remember you get the first, all of us have that feeling, the first time you get the note from the AARP, you get it in the mail. I know I ripped it up the first four or five times, but it kept coming. No matter what I did, the thing kept coming. They would deluge you with information. But finally, they hit the magic age. They're 65 years old. Thank God. Retirement. This is beautiful. This is what they've been waiting for all their life. They've been saving up. And now is their time to travel the world, to have a good time. They have a pension. They have a nice IRA savings. And they have a few dollars. They're going to help their kids a little bit. If they want to buy a house a little bit, they'll give them some money. They're certainly going to give them some money for their birthdays and their anniversaries. And they're going to buy presents for their three grandchildren that they have, or four grandchildren. And so it's their life. It's the American way of life. It's the Jewish American way of life in a way, except for us. Because now, let me introduce you to this other couple, Chaim and Ruchi Goldberg. Chaim and Ruchi Goldberg, yeah, they're almost like John and Mary, except they're a little different. You see, he's an accountant, just like John was an accountant, and he's a CPA, and he worked for a large firm, but of course, he left. Chaim left to start his own firm, because the Jews like to start their own business. So Chaim started his own firm, and Baruch Hashem, he was very successful. He had a nice profession. She, Ruchi, went into the time-honored tradition of what's going on all over today. Whenever you speak to anybody, what do you do? PT, OT, ST, whatever it is and so on, one of those little things, that's what they're going to do. It's a great profession for a Jewish woman to be in. It's a great profession for anyone. You can set your hours and study employment. It's a great, great thing. She does that. And they get married when they're 20 years old. They're both 20 years old. And believe me, and I tell you, Ruchi's mother was nervous already. When she was 18, she was already getting nervous. But okay, she gets married, she's 20 years old, and together they're blessed over the next 20 years. Different stages, they're blessed with 6 children. Not unheard of in our world, pretty common number, nothing crazy. They have 6 children. And the last one is actually 17 years younger than the eldest one. Big gap. We see that all the time in our families also. It's very common in our families to have tremendous age gaps between people because we start so young. And they're now 40 years old. And when they have this child, they're now 40 years old. And during all this time, all their children have been going to yeshiva every single year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's no time to save for the college education. We've got to live now. We've got to pay our tuition right now. And they send them to yeshiva. What was the tuition? It could range. It could be $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year. Enormous amounts of money that they had to pay to send their children to yeshiva. And it left them with some savings, and they did okay. They had some savings, but not a lot. It's pretty hard with 6 children going to yeshiva to be able to really save a lot of money. And so now their first child, Baruch Hashem, finally gets married. And when they get married, both of them, Ruchi and Chaim, are now the ripe old age of 42 years old. 42 years old, their children are married, and over the next 20 years, all of their children get married, and now they hit the magic age of 65. Just like John and Mary, they hit the magic age of 65. And at this point, they already have 18 grandchildren, and there are a whole batch more that will be coming down the pike. This is their family. Believe me when I say they have a great quality of life, and it's a wonderful life. But financially, they're in a different situation than John and Mary, because their children now, if they have 6 children, and now they have 18 grandchildren, maybe 20, maybe 22, maybe 24, they're going to have to pay tuition, and they're going to have to pay for housing. And so it's almost impossible to retire, because if you speak to some of the people in our community, they'll tell you that as they get older, their responsibilities become more. In the world that we know of, in the American society, as you become older, your responsibilities become less. In our world, they become more, because now we have more children, more grandchildren, there's more tuition to pay, and all kind of other things that go on. So this is a tale of two families totally different. One, our family, the Torah world, one, the regular people who are out there. And we have to be cognizant of one thing, and it's unfortunate, but we have an economic model that doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's not sustainable long term. We all know that. Everybody knows that. And so what we try to do is put a lot of band-aids on this problem, because we can't solve it. We're trying to solve it. We're trying to do everything we can to solve it. But in a way, it's almost impossible. And I can tell you, at the Orthodox Union, we devote an enormous amount of money and resources to try to solve this problem. When we talk about Teach New York and Teach LA and Teach Florida and so on, because we understand that the solving the tuition crisis is probably the greatest challenge we have in our world. And it's not because, you know, people think it's because yeshivas are spending so much money, it's a terrible thing. They could have less administration, they could do better buying. 70 to 80% of all the costs are personnel. And I can tell you right now, they're not overpaid. A Rebbe in a yeshiva, a Mora in a yeshiva, they're not overpaid. They're really, matter of fact, they probably are underpaid. And so we have this problem, and we have to try to find a way of solving it. But until we find a way of solving it, And are we going to find a way of solving it? I think we might. I think we might have a way of solving it. We're talking about tuition vouchers. We're talking about communities in which they give, you know, kind of stipends. We're talking about STEM funding where, you know, the government will pay for science and technology education. We're trying to find so many different ways of getting the government to pay for the part, at least the secular part. Maybe not the Limudei Kodesh, but certainly the secular part, if we can get them to do that. And the Orthodox Union is spending an enormous amount of resources on this, and they've done a wonderful job. Maury Litwack, other people, have done a great job making this a priority. Alan Fagan just retiring, it was one of his priorities. I'm proud to say, when I was president, we initiated this program and we continued to work on it, but it's out there, and there's no question that it's still an issue. Because you see, we have two major things that happen in our life. One is real estate and one is tuition. Let's talk about real estate. In order for us to be from Jews, in order for us to be Torah Jews, we've got to live near a shul. We have to. I mean, how far could someone walk? I mean, they'll walk a half a mile, three quarters of a mile. They're not moving 5 miles away. And so everything is always centered around the community. We build communities. That's a great thing, by the way. We build communities. Other people do not build communities. I'm not going to give you the name, okay? But it's a true story. A very good friend of mine, who I know very well through the Conference of Presidents, who was one of the heads of the conservative movement, a very, very nice man, kept Shabbos, didn't drive on Shabbos, a kosher, a good friend of mine, retired. And he called me up to tell me. He said, you wouldn't believe it, but you're going to be proud of me. I am now part of the Orthodox Union. I said, really? You were head of the conservative movement all your life. What do you mean you're part of the Orthodox Union? He said, I daven now, and I joined. In Boca Raton, I joined the synagogue because I retired. I joined the Boca Raton synagogue. Why? Because there was no community near me. As a conservative rabbi, the synagogue was in a highway someplace. I can't go there. My wife and I don't drive. And so they joined. So we have to live near a community. We have to live near a shul. That means prices go up. Because in our community, we have expensive housing. We just do. We have expensive housing. We can't help it. It's part of who we are. And there's nothing we could do about it. And like everything else, the prices of those houses have gone up dramatically. Because you see, we haven't kept up. Society hasn't kept up with the inflation that's going on. Let me give you an example. If you bought a house 25 years ago, I live in Woodmere. If you bought a house 25 years ago, you could have paid $300,000 to $400,000 to buy a very, very nice house, a really nice house. That house today is over $1 million. So it's gone up 150%. Have the salaries gone up 150%? No. They haven't gone up. The salaries have not kept up. And so all of a sudden now real estate is so expensive and then we can't help it. We have to live in our communities. That's why also we try to start our own communities. We're always trying to find a new community. Let's branch out a little. Let's go someplace else, which we have never been to before. That's also very important to do that. But it's a reality. Our real estate is very, very expensive. The second thing is our yeshiva tuition. And we spoke about that. When I talk about the economic situation, we in the Orthodox Jewish community, in order to be an Orthodox Jew, you've got to be in the top 5% of wage earners in America. Now, that's not sustainable. That's not a sustainable model. And even if you could be in the top 5%, if you then have 5 or 6 or 7 children, how does that translate itself? What happens if one of them is not being able to work, or two of them, and you have to help? So it gets to the point where the numbers just don't add up. And that's where we find ourselves today, because the numbers have changed for the yeshiva tuition. Once again, yeshiva tuition in the last 25 years has gone up probably 150 to 200%. And why? It's gone up because we had to pay our teachers. They deserve it. They weren't getting paid a living wage. A Rebbe in yeshiva, you know, didn't get paid what he should get paid. A Mora didn't get paid what she should get paid. We had to change it. We had to find ways of giving them more money, which means it's costing us more money to do this. This is a reality. This is where we are. But it's true in general society. I have to look up yesterday when I knew I was going to give the speech. I looked up in UCLA for non-residents in 1997, It costs $13,485 to go to UCLA as a non-resident. In the year 2020, it costs $45,000. $45,000. So it's going up way over 200%. It's just not what we're talking about. We're talking about in general, this is what's going on. And so we've got to figure out a way to make it work. And we've got to figure out a way of taking this cost and getting it down. And hopefully we're going to find some ways of doing it. If we could get the cost of yeshiva education down to a more reasonable number, I believe we'll help solve some of the issues that we are going through as grandparents, because this is becoming a major, major challenge. Now, look, but in general, when we look at society, we realize that people are living longer. Today, Baruch Hashem, many, many people have grandparents and great-grandparents, people they could relate to. And also because of the fact that many of us grew up, even though we're older, but we didn't grow up in such a different society from our kids or grandkids. I grew up in America. I lived in New York. My wife lived in New York. We went to yeshiva. We went to camp. You know, we went away. We had a car. We didn't do everything, but you know, yeah, we didn't have instant communication, but we lived to a certain extent. We lived the same kind of life that our grandkids are living, and so we relate better to them. Years ago, it wasn't always that way. My grandparents, I couldn't always relate to them if they spoke Yiddish or they came from Europe and they had a different life. They lived a different life than I lived. It wasn't exactly the same life that I'm living. So today we can relate to our kids, which means we have a better relationship, and they turn to us and they look to us for guidance. But it's important, because studies have already shown that grandparents have a great role to play when it talks about guidance to kids in religious education. I read something just that said the other day, a study of 1,150 Jewish college students conducted by Barry Kozman said that grandparents who accompany their children and grandchildren to synagogue and other Jewish settings are likely to feel strong attachment to Israel and the Jewish people. That's what it is. We are sometimes their link to the Jewish life. And so they look to us for guidance. They look to us for advice. They look to us to see what we can do this. So, and I looked just recently, one of the schools in my community, Hebrew Academy of Long Beach, they put out their financial statement, which is great. I love it when people put out a financial statement. They said that 6% of the money that they raise comes from grandparents. So grandparents are now being seen by other institutions as a viable source of revenue. And that's why you wonder why they have all these great programs that they're having. Yes, they want to have the programs, and it's important to have Dora Ladora and to have grandparents come, but they're also wanted because they want to have that connection. And I don't blame them, because they certainly look for it and they need it. But that presents challenges. First of all, when you have a relationship with your kids, and it's a close relationship, and it's even a financial relationship because you're helping out. So the question comes, where should they go to school? Where should they go to camp? What about other things that they should do? Do we have a say in what happens? What about, do we have a say if we spend some of the money on it? Does that change anything? The fact that maybe we're paying for the summer camp, does that give us a right to say what camp they should be going to, what they should be doing? Those are questions that I think we're finding all the time. And this is where we are as far as being from grandparents. And that presents a question, because I really talked about the financial aspect, and I talked about yeshiva education. We know it's expensive, and we know that there are scholarships. And now today in the scholarship world, it doesn't mean that someone's going for nothing. I know someone told me their bill for yeshiva tuition was over $120,000, and they got a scholarship, and they now pay $90,000. That's a nice scholarship, but it's still a lot of money. It's still a lot of money. Now, what happens if they have a scholarship and you have your grandparents, and we're grandparents? Do we have a responsibility to pay for the difference? After all, our grandchildren are getting a scholarship. And what about if we decide we really want to help our kids? Kids need a new kitchen. They need some renovations in their house. The kids need clothing. All the things that go on a normal point of view, do we have the right to do that? Or because the children are getting scholarships, we don't have the right to do that. This is a big issue and an issue that comes up all the time. And I want to look at it through the eyes of the school, because I think when the school looks at it, and I understand completely what the school is trying to do. The school is basically trying to say, look, if you're giving a scholarship and you can help them, why aren't you helping us pay tuition? I understand the school's point of view completely. I really do. And if I was running the school, I would probably agree with them. However, let's look at it from the other point of view, because it's always important to look at both sides. You know, someone told me one time, the concept of why we say we haven't is an ayin hara. An ayin hara you have because that you look at it with one eye. You never say a nayim, because when you open both eyes, you see the big picture. I want to look at the big picture. I want to look at it from the school's point of view, and I want to look at it through my point of view. The school's point of view says, we're giving scholarships. If you could afford it, why aren't you helping out? There's no question they could use it. And I agree with them completely. On the other hand, from my point of view, or a grandparent's point of view, you could say, look, I did my thing. I did my thing. I paid my tuition. I sent my children to yeshiva, and I paid for my tuition. And so therefore, why am I not entitled to do what I want with my money? It is my money. Let's say they need some renovations in their house. Why should I not be able to help them with that? It makes sense to me. Why shouldn't I help them with some summer camps? Now, you know, there are schools today that basically say, I know schools that say if your child is on a scholarship and they go to a summer camp, they're not entitled to the scholarship. Now, I understand what they're trying to do. I understand their point of view, but I understand the other point of view. It's a dilemma. Sometimes children, well, this year, of course, hardly anyone went to camp. Some people did, but generally speaking, camp's a good thing for kids. They should get out. They should be out. They should be out in the fresh air. They should be doing activity. They shouldn't be stuck being home. As a grandparent, we certainly want our kids to do that. And if we help out, could you imagine a grandparent helping out their children and giving them some money so their grandkids could go to camp? And all of a sudden the school says, well, that's it, no scholarship. It's a harsh thing, but on the other hand, I understand where they're coming from. So we have to talk about that also. And then I just read recently about an article, it was very interesting, that when the kids go to Israel now, on the gap year, they go to Israel on the gap year. Part of the gap year is they go on a trip to Poland. They go to see the camps, and they go to see what goes on. Very, very, very important thing. And the school said, if anybody gets a scholarship to come for the year, they can't go on that trip, because we don't think it's right. I know a man who is a Holocaust survivor, a grandfather. He said to me, I want my grandchild to see what I went through. I mean, I can't help them give $5,000 towards that trip. And the yeshiva said, I'm sorry. If you have $5,000, give it to us because we need the money. Your child has a scholarship. And those are issues that are coming about. Those are issues that we're seeing in our world, where we as from Jews now, because we have, thank God, many children and grandchildren, and the financial pressures are so hard. We're seeing this is really something which is coming about. And that creates another issue, which is really, what's the priority for us when it comes to giving tzedakah? After all, Shulchan Aruch gives us certain categories of where we give our tzedakah, and family is first. And then comes the people in your community, etc. If your family needs it, isn't that your first form of obligation? And so I've gone out, unfortunately, you know, when you're involved in the Jewish world, you know, as one of my rabbis used to say, life is a bowl of cherries. He used to tell me life's a bowl of raising kids and raising money. That's what life's about. And you know what? When I had to go out to raise money and I would ask people, they would say to me, I'm sorry, I have X amount of children. I've got to help them out. I've got to pay for their tuition. I've got to help pay for other things that they have. I've got to pay for their financial obligations. And therefore, I cannot afford to pay for other things. So is this going to change the priorities? In other words, are grandparents going to be at a certain point where the only thing they could ever do is pay for their children and grandchildren because they are the ones who are going to be doing it? And so then we get back to the question of retiring. And this is an issue for us in the Orthodox Torah world. Could we ever really retire? Because as our obligations become more and more and more, it sometimes it becomes even harder to think about retirement. While other people are thinking, this is it, 65, we could enjoy the golden years, there's no question that for some of us, and for many of us, we have to continue to work because our family depends on it. Our family is counting on it. And these are issues that we're going to be dealing with. These are issues that we deal with in our society. Now look, as I said at the very beginning, I'll trade this, and I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't trade it with anybody. I wouldn't trade it with anybody I know. I wouldn't trade it with John and Mary. I wouldn't trade their life that they have, not for one iota. I would rather be Chaim and Ruchi. I think what we have is so beautiful, but we have to face the reality. From a financial point of view, we have a problem. You know, one day at the NCSY, a parent called me. A man called me and said to me, you know, I love what you're doing at NCSY. My two girls go to NCSY. I'm so happy about it. He said, but you've got a product that I can't afford. I can't afford your product. I can't afford to send my kids to yeshiva. Do you know that at NCSY sometimes you have a wonderful kid who's in high school and the kid is so turned on and they wanna study and they love Torah and everything. And sometimes the advisors tell them, wait till you go to your gap year in Israel. Why? Because they can't go back to the parent. They can't say to the parent, fine, send them to Ramaz, it's $40,000 a year, or Flatbush, or Haftar. You can't say that to parents. They don't even understand it. But we have a model that's a problem. Look, we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure out a way of making it more affordable, and it's going to help. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to definitely let us do it. But we do have to deal with the realities from a financial point of view. And as I said, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And so when I really look at this thing, I also look at where we are now in COVID, when we are in this pandemic. Have we learned a lesson from what happened? Have we learned that we don't have to have simchas that have 800 people? Not everybody in the world that you ever met once in your life has to be invited to your kid's wedding. They don't. They really don't. We've learned the lesson. We've learned that you can have 100 people, 150, 200 people. And people could be invited on a Zoom and they could feel the sameach and they could feel what's going on. We've learned that. Hopefully we've learned that that things have to change. You know, the Gemara tells us a story about Rabbi Gamliel. You know that until Rabbi Gamliel changed the rules, you know what happened? People were spending so much money on funerals. Funerals. They were spending thousands and thousands of dollars on funerals that people couldn't afford. They were leaving, unfortunately, their relatives on the side of the road because of this. Rabbi Gamliel made a takana, bury me in shrouds. Make it as simple as possible. And that's what we have till this day. No matter who the person is, no matter how rich they are, no matter how many homes they have and how many vacations they had, after 120, they get buried in a simple way, in a shroud. Rabbi Gamliel taught us that. Maybe now we have to learn different kinds of things. And maybe we also have to look at some new educational models. We have to keep our eyes open. Maybe we saw what happened with Zoom. We saw what happened with online education. Maybe we could find a way of combining both. Maybe we should look for new models in education, ones that are more affordable, ones that we could possibly have as a sustainable model. We have to be creative. We have to be smart about it. But we have to realize that we, as from Jews, are in a wonderful position. Financially, we'll have to deal with it. We have to figure this out. Every generation always thinks they want the next generation to have more. I know certainly my grandparents thought they wanted their children to have more. My children, definitely, you know, I wanted them to have more than I have. It hasn't turned out that way. And now I'm happy if my grandchildren have the kind of life I gave my children. If my grandchildren could have the life that I gave my children, I'd be very happy. That's the reality of where we are. And as I said, you know, we're dealing with it. There are some financial issues. We have to deal with it. We have to figure it out. And there are issues that we have to confront. But the reality is that we have a wonderful life. And even though financially sometimes we're challenged, we have to put life in perspective. Simplicity is better. I think we learned that all from COVID. Simplicity is fine. Let's go back to a more simple life. Even the yeshivas, why do they have to have dinners every single year? Maybe they have it every other year. Why does everyone have to make when there's a wedding? Why does it have to be a l'chaim and a vart? And an engagement party, and a Shabbos challah, and then a wedding, and then 7 days. And, you know, I mean, let's make it simple. Let's try to cut down the cost. Let's try to create a better quality of life. But we as grandparents, we're fortunate. Yes, we do the best we can, and we try to do the best we can. And I would give up anything in my retirement. I would make sure that I would do one. I do not want to be Mary and John. I really don't. So Baruch Hashem, I think we've achieved a lot. We've done a lot of good things. We have our challenges, but we'll meet those challenges. I know there's not a lot of time left, Rebbe Steinick, but I'm happy to take a few questions if there are any. Okay,
so there are a couple. Okay, so the first one is, given distance learning, I assume they're talking about COVID, what are the prospects of yeshivas reducing tuition?
Well, you know, I think that if it becomes a reality for a long enough period of time, they're going to have to reduce tuition because parents don't want to pay. Parents don't want to pay the same amount of money for an education that's an online education. So much of what we want is not an online education. But what I think it's created, though, is it's created an opportunity for people to realize that it can work. Online education is a very viable source of education. We've got to take advantage of the technology. If we could figure out a way of doing that, I think it's going to help. And I think hopefully it's going to be one of the things that we do down the pike. Yes.
Okay. What can the OU, and I'm sure other organizations, do to work with communities to create a mega fund for Jewish education to lower the costs for Jewish day school education, which includes summer camps, that is a source of Jewish education, also the cost to participate in NCSY, other organizations. So, you know, working with communities, which...
Well, look, let's understand that for the non-from world, the way they look at it, and I've had these discussions many, many times, with extremely wealthy people. And their answer to me is, listen, you, quote unquote, an Orthodox Torah Jew, are gonna send your kids to yeshiva no matter what. So you're gonna do that, whether I support it or I don't support it. And so why should I have to pay for what you're going to do anyway? Now, could we convince them that the future of Jewish life is dependent on that? I think we're seeing something in Israel now. Listen, in Israel for the first time, Israel is now having in their diaspora affairs, they are now allocating money and funds to help diaspora Jewry. Why? Because they realize without diaspora Jewry, they're going to lose out. But it's very hard to get the very wealthiest people. Look, if the very wealthiest people, if you look at the Forbes 400, there are probably 100 Jewish people there. How many of those 100 people are giving money to Jewish causes? They're not. I wish we could convince them. If we could convince them, then we'd be in great shape. But you know, one of the things that's happened, we live in a world of polarization. We see it now, Democrat, Republican, we see it all over. People are terribly polarized. And that means it's very hard for people to bring other people in. I remember when I used to go years ago to like a dedication of a building, and they would dedicate a building, and it would be dedicated by Mr. and Mrs., you know, Jack Cohn. And who were they? The guy with the little white yarmulke that would be up there sitting on the stage. He wasn't really from, but he had a feeling for Jewish life, and he was willing to give money to Jewish education. Today, if you look at Jewish education in schools, ask most of the principals, ask most of the executive directors of the yeshivas where their money comes from. It comes from the from community. They're not getting that much money. So we're trying to do work with Federation. The future of the Jewish life is with Jewish education and Torah, but it's a hard sell.
Okay. If a grandparent has, as everyone has, limited funds, what is the obligation or the priority? What should the priority be? Should the grandparent, he or she, themselves are so that they know they can safely retire, or is there obligation to help their grandchildren? And then down the line, someone might need to help them if they run out of money. You know, where are the priorities here?
Everybody has their own priorities, their own set of priorities. I don't think anyone should become destitute because they have to pay for their grandchildren. I don't believe that's really where it's at. But I do think that sometimes we have to stretch a little bit more, and maybe we have to push ourselves to continue to work a little bit harder and a little bit longer. First of all, it's probably better for you. It's probably healthier for you. It's better for survival rates. So I don't think it's so bad for people. No one has to retire at a particular age. I mean, if they want to, they can. And I think helping your children is a very gratifying thing. To see your grandchildren and you see them grow up in Derech HaTorah, it's a wonderful thing. Don't become destitute. Don't sell your house because of that. But on the other hand, I think it's an important thing to do. I think all of us should try it as much as we can. Believe me, the nachas you get is worth all the money.
Okay. Can grandparents, I know you did this a little bit, but okay. Can grandparents dictate to their children how the money you give them for your, how the money should be spent, the school, insist the children go to work? Okay, and with that, before children get married, many parents obligate themselves to help out in a certain way for a certain amount of time. In this very unstable time with job instability, health instability, is it legitimate for a parent or grandparent to obligate themselves in that way?
Everyone has to know their own situation. I mean, listen, I think what happened in March with the pandemic and COVID changed the world completely. You know, it turned the world upside down. People who were very wealthy lost a lot of their money. People lost a lot of their jobs, depending on the industry you were in. I think all of us learned a lesson from this whole thing. You know, children also have to understand, grandchildren have to understand, nothing is forever. You know, sometimes I meet a young couple, they're gonna learn in Colel. Yes, the parents have agreed everyone's gonna pay a certain amount of money, but what happens if it changes? Life is change. The only thing that's constant in life is change. So I think people have to grow up and understand that nothing is forever, nothing lasts forever. You could do the best you can, but to take on an obligation, you know, today in this world, the way we are, it comes with a caveat, as long as I can. Just like sometimes people will say, you know, you have six children, not everyone is gonna get married at the same time of your economic life. And so maybe one is a better, one is not. And you have to adjust to the reality. I think it's a terrible thing when I meet parents who can't afford to make a certain kind of wedding and they say, well, I made it for my other kids. Yeah, well, maybe you were doing better then. Maybe things were changing. You know what? I've gone to a lot of backyard weddings. They're pretty nice. They really are. And you know what? Those couples will be as happy as some other people who get married in wherever the place is and they're spending, you know, who knows how much amount of money. I think we have to learn simplicity. It's an important lesson.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Okay, David, thank you very much.
Learned a lot. I think you've given everybody a lot to think about. Oh, and by the way, Anthony still is at the OU.
Great.
And working hard to make sure all of us are, when we go back at some point, we're all still out of the office. Great. Safe.
Thank you.
And one everything else. And
okay,
his whole
take
staff.
Care.
They know a lot about kite now.
Okay, be well. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Speaking of grandparenting, which we've been talking about, I want to thank everyone for the beautiful wishes of Mazel Tov I received regarding the bris of my grandson last Thursday. It was a beautiful and safe event during COVID, and he was named from my father, Shlomo, who was nifter just short of his 99th birthday. So we should always have simchas to share safely together in whatever way we can do it. I just want to remind everyone, on Thursday, we'll be discussing the importance of voting with one of the representatives of OU Teach Florida. So that's Thursday. You'll be getting, of course, emails about it. Thinking ahead to next week, Tuesday will be the second session we'll be doing with Nefesh B'Nefesh. And on Thursday, we just got this, we're very excited. We will have the opportunity to have a specialized COVID update for our demographic with Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glott, who is chairman of the Department of Medicine of Infectious Diseases at Mount Sinai South Nassau. And of course, he's also the assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Woodmere and associate rabbi at Congregation Anshei Chesed. Rabbi Dr. Glott is absolutely on the front lines of COVID, and the OU frequently asks his advice. This is really such an honor for us and a wonderful opportunity. We will not be opening the chat during his presentation, but I will be sending out a form hopefully later today and with the next couple of emails. So if anyone does have any questions they'd like to see addressed, put it on that form and we will get it to him ahead of time so that he can be prepared and answer as many questions as possible. We'll have to get them in probably 2 days before the event. That's a week from Thursday. So watch your emails for all of this information, for all the registration. Again, we want to thank all of our partnering synagogues that help us out each week. And if your synagogue is not listed on the partner list, please contact me because we're happy to include them. Everybody have a wonderful day. We'll see you on Thursday. Be safe, be healthy. Thank you, Stephen, so much again for that.
My pleasure. Be well. Bye-bye.